In this episode of Houston Tech Talks, Miles invites Nathan Murphy, software engineer at Tesla, to discuss net neutrality and the effects it has on the public, and potentially what a public information service would look like. All right, so you're tuned into another episode of Houston Tech Talks podcast. The focus here is to talk about a lot of the current trends, current events, resources, and information that pertain to the Houston scene, the Houston ecosystem, as far as startups, entrepreneurship, and tech professionals and creatives. Today we have Nathan Murphy, and I'll let him tell you more about who he is, but I'm Miles, the CEO and co-founder of Devland, and today we're going to have a discussion a little bit about net neutrality.
Yeah, hey, how's it going, Miles? Thanks for having me, man. This is really awesome to be a part of this. My name is Nathan Murphy. I'm a staff software engineer at Tesla. Small little car company you may have heard of that sends cars into space. I work on building internet-based smart devices that allow Tesla to coordinate electrical systems that we build, either in our cars or in our batteries, with grid providers like utility companies or electricity market operators. So I'm here to basically, you know, chime in on some of the things that I see as a key important provisions of net neutrality, and in general what I find to be, you know, the importance of net neutrality in a democratic context, and so hopefully we'll be able to, you know, have a fun insightful conversation around all those.
So what's your connection back to Houston?
So I grew up in Missouri City, Texas. Same home, same neighborhood, same block all my life. My parents ended up there in the 1950s is when my dad showed up, and my mom showed up in Houston around the 1980s. So they got married in Houston. I was born there, my little brother was born there, and that's where pretty much all of my childhood memories, land and sit.
Cool. And how did Houston influence the professional you are now? And influence your decision to really deep dive into this industry?
I think I was always kind of a nerd as a kid. I remember I had a cousin, and he was studying electrical engineering at HCC. And he showed me for the first time, like, this book on the internet. And I had no idea what it was. You know, I mean, I knew what a telephone was. I knew what it meant to send a message over voicemail, and there was like this thing called a computer that you can use and plug into your phone jack, but, you know, I didn't have a concrete idea of what this thing called the internet was. And he drew a diagram on a sheet of paper for me that kind of laid out in a very, very basic way what the internet was all about, and that kind of sparked my curiosity at a very early age to learn more about what was going on in the space.
Kind of like explaining recursion to a five-year-old.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, those things that just blew my mind, right? Because, like, you're like, what?
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. That's a trip. That's a trip. So, kind of jumping off into the conversation on net neutrality, really just want to talk and focus about how the past provision was intended to operate. Maybe some discussion around, you know, some flaws to that. I do want to talk a little bit more about how kind of some of these large corporations were already able to take advantage of certain provisions and workarounds to control and throttle data. Mm-hmm. And then two, I want to talk about now how the repeal of net neutrality has opened the opportunity for companies to do things like sponsor data, if they're in these integrated tech telecom companies where, for example, AT&T has U-verse and DirecTV and all these different partners, mm-hmm. how they can spread it out and create kind of monopolized opportunities for people that are doing business with them. So kind of start off with this back and forth discussion around like the original provision, its intentions, maybe some areas that needed clarity, and then go from there.
Yeah, so I think it might even, you know, do some justice to talk about or even define what net neutrality is. Mm-hmm. And net neutrality is this very fundamental principle that no person or no client of an information service should have their information restricted, constrained, or limited in a way that prevents their access to information. And the way I see it, you know, it's treating all data points on the web as fair and equal. And to me, you know, I look at this in the context of a democratic society, because the way I look at it, in a democratic society, you know, the ideal situation is for all citizens in a democracy to be well informed, right? So if you have a situation where some citizens have access to information to make decisions and other citizens don't, well, you won't have a really well-functioning democracy, because you won't have people who can make informed, intelligent decisions using real information, hard facts, cold logic that's available to virtually anyone today in an ideal web. And, you know, this is kind of a stretch for me, but I like to kind of use this as an analogy. Like, you could imagine the kind of uproar there was in the 1960s when people didn't have, you know, access to polling stations, to voting booths, right? Mm-hmm. Where you had states and governments restricting people's access just to vote. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's net neutrality is almost that other end, mm-hmm. where in order to make a political decision, in order to even cast the ballot, you need information to cast that mm-hmm. vote, right? And if we're restricting people's access to vote, If we're restricting people's access to information, we're effectively restricting people's ability to make informed decisions in a democracy. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's kind of a good motivating factor for why I think people should be equally concerned and even, you know, vocal in their opposition to something like this, because to me, it's almost tantamount to the kind of restrictions that we saw like in the Jim Crow era. Granted, it's not states and local governments likely to create these kind of restrictions, but corporations themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's generally where I find the conversation kind of tipping in one way or another.
Yeah. So I'm wondering too, like, how do we get from pre-2015 to where a lot of what we know or have context of the most recent net neutrality rules came into play in 2015, and then now leaving that, still this idea of an information service where access is still limited to large telecom contracts and things of that nature. You still don't have like this presence of like public and free Wi-Fi or public and free information. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's probably one of the reasons I probably disagree with it being innately an information service, because it's not like an analog phone line in your house where like you plug it in and you have access to some portion of the internet.
Right.
There's still a subpopulace of people who have access to the internet in a way that, yeah, I don't know. I think, just to play devil's advocate a little bit, like the telecom companies have developed the infrastructure and the resources and assets that make this service available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there hasn't been any creation of other alternative infrastructure to make information available. To me, it's kind of like, how do you create guidelines governing a system that really isn't structured to allow public information, Like what?
Right.
And then two, what would a public information service, i.e., a version of the internet or the internet itself, look like?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot bundled up in those questions, and you know, hopefully I can help demystify, you know, some of what those terms are, because so you know, Miles, you're using this term information service, and that's actually a very well defined term in the FCC's sort of jargon and vernacular. So in 2015, there was an order, the Open Internet Order, which classified broadband companies, internet service providers like Verizon, AT&T, as communication providers. Mm-hmm. And in that way, they were classified using legislation that was created in the 1930s under the Communications Act that treated companies like Verizon and AT&T as public utilities, much like phone carriers, yeah. Gas companies, right, water utilities, so. Right? So that happened in 2015. And in 2017, fast forward to Ajit Pai being the commissioner, though that order was effectively repealed. Mm. So that suddenly these internet service providers became reclassified as what are called information sources. Mm-hmm. And information sources, quote unquote, are under a different category of legislations that public utility companies are not. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of, you know, to kind of play along with that devil's advocate scenario, you know, there are a lot of people who are anti-net neutrality for mm-hmm. some of these same reasons. Mm-hmm. One, okay, people will say that, oh, the Communications Act was written in the 1930s, it's outdated. You know, it doesn't really apply to today's model of, you know, communication. Two, people say that, you know, having net neutrality, forcing companies, you know, to abide by this governmental scheme would just strangle investment, strangle innovation. Mm-hmm. And three, you know, a lot of people who are against net neutrality will say that, you know, they can't provide the best service for the customers or the ideal set of, mm-hmm. you know, consumer choices for the users of their services. And all of those things, if you start with the fundamental principle that all people should have access to information free of restrictions, mm-hmm. then the vision for what I think, and tell me if you agree with this or not, of the open internet or of an internet version 2 or of an ideal internet would be one where no monopoly on the people who have constructed the physical pipelines and wires that construe the internet into something that, you know, none of us have control of. Mm. I'd say that, like, the ideal situation is one where, you know, maybe we all have our own routers at home, and maybe we all figure out a way to lay a bunch of, you know, Ethernet cables and fiber cables across our homes, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, we all pay our taxes. And insofar as we are paying our taxes to a government that regulates these things and is supposed to regulate these things, well, then the proceeds that we pay as taxpayers should go to the things that allow us to become effective citizens in a democracy. And one of those things are, you know, having open access to information, mm-hmm. having limited controls on the people that have physically put the hardware in place, mm-hmm. and can think of those things as shared resources rather than owned resources by any of these individual monopolies. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, man, that's where I see things shifting if there's enough public demand for these kinds of, you know, models.
Yeah. No, I think that's what's necessary, and I agree with what you were saying. And going further, it really is a requisite to define service beyond just an information service. You know, I feel right now, because it's paid, it's a consumer information service, that the access is granted through somebody, if not you, right, paying right. to access it. What does a public information service look like in terms of the internet?
Yeah.
What does equipment and hardware and public access look like in order to access that type of internet? And to me, that's, we start getting into a space where we actually understand the power of the internet as being the information mm-hmm. resource right. that is classified as. But I think currently, just the idea that you could live in anywhere, specifically like middle America, middle United States of America, mm-hmm. and not have access to this information resource, one, because the telecom providers in that region haven't expanded the type of bandwidth to your region that's necessary, which there are a number of areas that's still running dial-up 56K offerings
yeah.
and low-grade DSL offerings that haven't been boosted up to higher bandwidths. I believe the current standard of offering just got upgraded to 25 megabits per second, and if you live in an urbanized area or somewhere that has bandwidth that's based off of some, you know, big pipe or fiber mm-hmm. optic line, that's really slow.
Yeah.
if you live in a house with more than two people, that's really slow internet for overall bandwidth. So, you know, I think there has to be a conception of a new wave thought about how to create the public access component to this information resource. And if that's done as simple as saying, like, hey, all websites that have .gov on the end of it, mm-hmm. you're able to access no matter what, no matter if you have like a contract with Comcast, if there's like an Xfinity hotspot near you, this service provider has to allow you free access to government websites. To me, that is an important component of that picture, because then, you know, we're getting a step further to actually utilizing what is constructed as an information service. And then to me, I don't see the block on that as far as how we gain access to government-specific information, but it still doesn't speak to the free speech component of the internet. And that's where I think is like there's a really difficult boundary there to make that possible, because it's like saying to Comcast, because I'm entitled to free speech, I'm entitled to free internet as well.
Right.
And I don't know if we've jumped into a thought space deep enough that has allowed for that type of design
mm-hmm.
at this point.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned free speech. You know, the First Amendment protects the right to free speech, but ain't no restrictions on what you need to pay in order to have that,
yeah.
you know, how to have that voice piece, right?
Yeah.
I think when going to your first question about like what would that open internet look like, I think it depends on scale, right? You could look at what kind of solutions countries like France, for instance, have, and this mm-hmm. is something at like a nation state scale, where, you know, people in France, there's a single telecom company, largely government owned, France Telecom. You pay in France for 100 megabits per second, roughly $20 a month.
Mm.
Now, someone in the United States would be like, damn, that's a steal. You're paying only that? I mean, I'm paying like $70 for my Comcast yeah. bill per month
yeah.
For a lesser quality service. And I think the ownership model in France, which is a much more socialist country than the United States, would be close to a situation where, you know, you wouldn't have individual monopolies of ownership on the physical cables and wires and systems that make up the internet, because there it's fundamentally treated as a public service. So I think, one, that has to happen. Like, there has to be a public perception that the internet is a public service
right.
and not a private thing that we pay to use.
Right.
And in fact, if you look at how the internet was built in the United States, I mean, the government, through infrastructure programs,
right.
paid these companies,
yeah, back-funded it,
right, yeah. to lay down and dig these cables, you know, into the ground and under the water, so that we have access to this information. So the idea that these companies themselves own them and operate them, you know, it's kind of a myth, because mm-hmm. it's sort of a shared model where, you know, money from public coffers coming from taxpayers went into this, as well as money from customers, both existing and future customers, and investments from shareholders that put cash into companies like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon. And also that's at the nation, you know, that's at the national scale, but you can like even drill down into like smaller versions of the internet. Like there's this one program called the Red Hook Initiative, Red Hook Housing Projects in Brooklyn. During Hurricane Sandy, you know, they were, sorry, during Superstorm Sandy, they were effectively locked from any kind of emergency alerts on or information on emergency preparedness or what to do in the event that, you know, something happened that was a life-threatening situation and people need to stay updated. So what they do, they built their own Wi-Fi system. Mm-hmm. They took money that they had from within the community and had volunteers, they had paid staff too, to like literally go out on top of the, you know, these brick houses and lay out a whole wireless web of LANs, of switches and routers and antennas that allowed them to stay up to date on information, right? There's another example I can think of, you know, during the Occupy movement that was going on in Wall Street and throughout all the different urban centers, some of the protesters, what they did was they brought their own, you know, they brought their own switches and routers, they brought their own laptops and computers, and they themselves created these small little networks that allowed them to exchange information without having to go through any of the networks that, you know, AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon put together. Mm-hmm. So they're definitely out there, and there's a bunch of resources we could look at of people who have, you know, created their own version of the web, their own version of the internet. And again, the challenge is scale, really. To be able to operate the web at a global scale and to be able to operate the internet in a free and open manner at a national scale or even at a state level scale, that's something that's really hard to do. And I think that's something that can only be done well and effectively when there's really strong public demand and opinion for these kind of resources.
Yeah, I just don't think we currently live in a world like that. We don't live in a place where, you know, that relationship with these telecom companies was birthed off of this idea that in the future their infrastructure would be utilized for public purpose.
Yeah, right.
Beyond their ability to privatize, I mean, to commodify or monetize the services. So it really does take you back to a blank sheet of paper and say, hey, like, what does this design look like? Because it wasn't built to perform in that way. And I think innately that is what drives my conflict with net neutrality in general, and just a discussion around the open internet, is this idea that we should think about the internet like we think about roadways. But even roadway construction is very difficult from a regulatory and legal sense, because you have all these different entities that have to cooperate to build these things using funding. Mm-hmm. So, and then you have a lot of private players and contributors in that space as well. So, you know, it's like, what does a public information service look like from a design, and how do you make this something that these telecom companies even want to participate in? Because to me, at this point, you know, the United States, just by our footprint, is just too large to implement the type of programs that a country like you mentioned, like France or somewhere else, could implement, because they're like the size of a state. Here, you have this necessity to generate some local-based programs that allow for information. I know there's a few ideas circulating about, you know, local mesh networks and kind of bouncing signals or you know, repeating signals for the internet within certain communities that don't have access to high speed. But over-air bandwidth is really crowded, and a lot of other things are really difficult to bring to pass. So, and also there's another model where, you know, locally, in certain cities or domains, there's a offline archiving or local caching of the web itself in a read-only state that allows access, but it doesn't really allow functional access in the same grade as you sitting at your computer using Facebook all day. So, yeah, I think that definitely the discussion for me today really pushes forward that conversation of who is going to design what the future of the internet looks like, if it is actually deemed to be a public information service and not just a consumer information service. And I don't think those things have to mutually exclusive. I think they can exist or coexist in a design together, but potentially in its pilot or initial phase, they may be segmented. And so I think that there's a necessity to bring about that change in some form or fashion.
Yeah, so definitely, man. There's this initiative called the Build Your Own Internet Workshop. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they're trying to put together is, and I encourage everyone to look this up, it's called the People's Open Network.
Mm-hmm.
And it really started off, it was definitely kickstarted by what happened in the net neutrality space.
Mm-hmm.
Because now people, who have these resources, there are people who just for fun like to collect, cables and switches and routers, and for they're hobbyists or they're amateur technologists,
mm-hmm.
who just have these things and they do this for fun.
Yeah.
They have these Ethernet cables and routers and antennas that they're willing to donate to build these small networks.
Mm-hmm.
So the People's Open Network is a really interesting space to be in. You can check out their what they're doing at peoplesopen.net, and check out what they're putting together, because what they're really trying to do is enable anyone to share their internet connection or extend their internet signal from neighboring nodes.
Right.
So long as you have a small little antenna or router or switch, which some of these are things that can be donated to you if you can't afford it or don't have the resources. Or maybe, some of them are cheap enough that you can afford. You can be a part of kind of like this community that they're trying to build. The People's Open Network, it operates out of Oakland. They have a hackerspace at Pseudo Room. They're a member of OmniCommons. OmniCommons is a 100% volunteer run space for community organizing, collaboration, and creative production. I do want to focus this in on the Houston space though. Here I am talking about Oakland, California, because that's where we live today. But, things like this, organizations and communities like this, can be sprouted in places like Houston, too.
A big example, for sure.
But, there's things to, draw inspiration from, and, this is one of them, for sure.
That's so cool. Yeah, I think that's a really solid look, just for starters, at some of the key topics around net neutrality and discussion points. I think that within the Houston Tech Talks Facebook group, we'll be dropping a little bit more information to drive discussion around net neutrality itself, and then just how do we get to a place of designing a new model for what a public information service would look like. And I think that Houston is definitely in a prime position to really come up with ideas like this, given the geographic displacement of these little smaller cities and kind of like that overlapping culture that you see in Houston. So I'm really interested to see if there's a way to bring about a program. And we're trying to work with one of our advisors right now to devise a model with Devlin, and to devise a model for something like this that we can run in a pilot phase and see where it goes. So I definitely appreciate you hopping in, and also appreciate for all the people that you brought into Houston Tech Talks. It's really cool to start lassoing people in, whether they live in Houston currently or they're a native by birth or claim. We really want to create that community and put a common board of resources together for people who are plugged in, and then for people who are trying to get plugged in or slightly interested in being plugged into what's going on in the Houston area, because we want to see Houston be great, and we definitely want Houston to be exposed to the things that we get the opportunity to see in different places, both here and around the world. So
thank you
for that conversation.
Yeah, appreciate it, Miles. It's a pleasure having spent this time with you, and I hope everyone on the Houston Tech Talks group, just chimes in. There's a lot of people on there, you know, you have a voice. You know, talk, tell us how you feel about these topics. You know, let us know, and you know, chime in on what you think are important issues to you. Because the beauty about technology is that, you know, the possibilities are endless. With the right amount of, you know, sweat, labor, and research, you know, almost anything is possible in this space. And Houston, I feel like, is in a very ripe situation with its influx of communities, you know, moving there, transplants coming there for jobs, mm-hmm. People of all backgrounds, like, landing in Houston. It's becoming a hugely cosmopolitan city,
mm-hmm.
you know, compared to New York or even Los Angeles, Bay Area. Houston is like a breeding, it's a very fertile ground right now, the way I feel in this space. And hopefully people carry on these conversations, you know, not just on the web, but like with their friends and family, neighbors, whomever.
Yeah, meetups in person. Yeah, that's the goal really of Houston Tech Talks, because we truly believe that there's a large opportunity to really stir up some new activity, because Houston in the past has been a launch pad for a ton of people and a ton of companies. And I just know just from my personal network, the number of individuals who were birthed or reared in Houston, went to Houston schools or Houston area schools, ended up traveling to universities around the country and you know, doing things in the creative or highly technical spaces, and founding companies or being the first employees, the first few employees of companies. There's definitely like a touch of Houston everywhere, just, you know, based on experience. Everywhere I go, I can meet a Houstonian in a relatively small amount of time of being wherever I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we have a privilege and a responsibility to extend those channels and roads back to Houston and greater opportunities for individuals who reside there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, as someone who grew up in Houston, and to all those people who have grown up in Houston and gone elsewhere, myself included, you know, this is an opportunity to give back to Houston as a community, and build that community through one-to-one, peer-to-peer relationships, you know, and not through this kind of top-down model that we see today in a lot of spaces.
Mm.
So hopefully we continue these conversations, and from those conversations, you know, we build these launch pads.
Yeah.
So yeah, again, Miles, appreciate you having me here, and cool. And thank you for everyone on the group and tuning in on the podcast, of listening in on this conversation.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.